Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for nearly 50 years.
Hello, and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews, a licensed therapist and professor of psychology at Alaska Pacific University. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and it's a great time to remember that mental health is health. It touches everything from your work and relationships to your physical well-being. According to SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, our minds and bodies are deeply connected. When you're under pressure, your body reacts, and when your physical health struggles, your spirit does too. This month, let's prioritize the mind-body connection, because a healthy mind leads to a healthier you. Take a breath, check in with yourself, and remember, you aren't alone. Here to help us understand the mind-body connection are three guests who work every day on the front lines of healthcare. First, we have Sarah Switzer, Clinical Director of Behavioral Health Integration at South Central Foundation. Then we have Brandy Stratman, a licensed clinical social worker at Providence Alaska Medical Center, and Dr. Aaron Newens, a clinical psychologist also at Providence. Welcome, welcome to the show. Let's start by getting to know a little bit about what each of you do and how you define the core concepts of today's show. Let's start with Sarah. Can you tell us just a little bit about yourself and the work that you do at South Central Foundation?
Absolutely. So I am the clinical director for behavioral health integration, and I work at Yagli Sheshkinka, which is Athabascan for Good Medicine House. So we do primary care behavioral health, so integrated behavioral health as a routine expected part of care across our system.
All right. Welcome, Sarah. Thank you. Okay, Brandy, you and Sarah are both licensed clinical social workers, or LCSWs. Would you first introduce yourself and then tell us a little bit about what you do at Providence?
Sure. So my name is Brandy Stratman, and I'm a part of the behavioral health continuum at Providence. And so I currently oversee the residential program and school-based programs, and then support our inpatient units and our critical access hospitals in Valdez and in Kodiak.
All right, thank you. And then could you explain how LCSWs differ from other mental health providers?
Yes, I mean, I would say that primarily I received my education here at UAA. I got both my bachelor's and master's in social work, and that was a generalist degree. And the thing I would say about social work that differs is that it's a good thing and a bad thing sometimes. Like, we're a master, or we're a generalist of all, but a master of none. And so you have to work really hard to become specialized. And so we have social workers in medical settings. We have social workers in primary care settings, in retirement and elderly care facilities. We have them within the police department. They're with all parts of our culture interwoven into support systems. So you have to work really hard to become specialized in one area. So I would say that's the primary difference, is that We're in lots of different spaces beyond mental health.
And doing slightly different things in all those places.
Yeah. Yes, and that was Dr. Aaron chiming in. How about you share about your work and perspective on the mind-body connection?
Yeah, so I am the pediatric psychologist. I work in the medical units at the Providence Hospital in the children's units. So I serve the pediatric hospital, the children's hospital, the pediatric ICU, and the NICU. And my service line is a psychiatry line called consultation liaison. So my job is entirely mind-body connection. I am consulted to see, the way I describe it to people typically is, I would be called when there is some sort of psychiatric component to the hospitalization or a psychiatric barrier to care that's impacting people that are in the hospital for a primary medical diagnosis, right? So even if they're in the hospital for a psychiatric diagnosis like an overdose or an eating disorder, they're in the medical units being medically treated. And then my job is to come help, you know, with the combination of the two, the psychiatric symptoms, whether it's the trauma and grief of your child being hospitalized or the psychiatric component of the hospitalization.
Sounds like a much needed niche.
Yes.
Okay. What? So historically, medical science has separated mental and physical health. How has modern medicine shifted that understanding?
I use this as kind of a ha-ha joke in when I talk to patients all the time, because it's such an absurd thing that we ever separated it, because it's not. I mean, everything is the brain, right? So you can't separate any of it. But I think logistically, this was separated originally. You know, you think about a medical unit. You have the generalists who, you know, the hospitalists would see sort of everyone, and then we would call in the specialists to treat each individual part of the body. And so I would be the psychiatric specialist, and maybe a cardiologist or a pulmonologist would come in. And part of integrated care that we'll talk about later is how we, you know, weave all of that together. But I think historically for the benefit of the doubt, perhaps it was separated for a logistics reason, and then also because we just had the stigma around mental health. And so I think as we grow respect for psychology, we really start to understand that you have to weave them together, or we're not going to be successful. And so no matter how many times a doctor explains a treatment plan, if there's a barrier to accessing that treatment plan, it's not going to go anywhere. So I think in modern medicine, we've really understood that in order for patients to be successful, we have to treat all of the symptoms combined and together, and that includes their thoughts, feelings, and actions around the diagnosis and the treatment.
Okay, wow. Brandy, we're going to turn to you. In your work providing mental health therapy, do you treat patients that are struggling with both physical and mental health illness?
Absolutely. I would say that most of the families in adolescents that have been in any of the places that I provide services, they often struggle with complex trauma, which comes with a host of physical symptoms. Often there's been a lack of access to appropriate medical care, so there's lingering effects of that long-term that patients have to navigate. And so really, one of the primary things that we really start with in any type of care is just awareness. Often people who are surviving have to shut off awareness not only to their body but to their mind, and they have to focus on the next thing that gets them their survival need met. And so one of the primary things we do is to build awareness and help them understand and pay attention to what's happening with kindness and the awareness that they can handle it with support. Because often when you start to look at your physical symptoms or your behavioral health symptoms and you pay attention, it's very overwhelming.
Yeah.
And so that's a primary place we start.
Okay. And Brandy, some people may think of talk therapy as just talking. How does traditional talk therapy actually influence our physical bodies?
One of the things that I have the privilege of doing with patients who are sharing any type of stories is to actually help them tune into their body and to notice what's happening. Oftentimes, people share something for the first time and all of a sudden realize that they have a sharp pain in their stomach as they're talking, but they feel concerned about that, or they feel embarrassed and they don't want to share it. And so helping them understand your body's been holding on to a lot to survive, and helping build their story connection with their body connection helps healing. So when we can tell our story in a calm body, it helps us heal. It helps wire our brain to remind us that we're not in that traumatic experience anymore and that we're safe. And without that connection, it often doesn't happen. And for anyone who's sat with people who tell the same traumatic story over and over again as if they're not connected to their body, it's because they're not. And then it's still held in their body in a way that keeps them feeling the symptoms and they don't progress.
And how do you bring social work perspectives into your one-on-one therapy?
I think one of the beautiful things that my social work education gave me was that from the moment of conception to birth and until death, our environment impacts who we are, how we survive, how we view the world, our relationships, our development. We're seeing so much research now, even in that early developmental stage where children aren't getting their needs met, that their brain is different, right? How they see the world is different. The landscape of their life is different. And helping people understand how their brain landscape has influenced their decision making, and building compassion and awareness along with opportunities to make different decisions is something that I think social work has given me the gift of.
Okay, and turning to Sarah, you work at South Central Foundation with individuals who are entitled behavioral health consultants. What exactly is a behavioral health consultant?
So a behavioral health consultant is a master's level clinician, and they are a part of the healthcare team. So part of this integrated model means that it's a briefer style of care because we want to have same day access. So we believe everyone should have same day access to behavioral health care, and kind of what Brandy was referencing as well, is that it's really across the lifespan. It's for the whole family. And we are looking at functional and quality of life issues now and today and figuring out what that means for next steps. So if someone needs a higher level of care, we help connect to that as well. But one of our biggest strengths is just being a part of routine care across the lifespan.
Okay, and Sarah, South Central Foundation has the NUCA system of care. Could you tell us about that program and how that particular system views the mind-body connection?
Absolutely. It really supports our vision and our mission, which is around wellness for Alaska Native people. It is relationship-based care, so we know that's one of the biggest ways that supports people making changes. And it's also team-based care, so it's really not having that separation between physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual wellness. And it's based on people's values, what's important to them, their culture, and that mind-body connection is essential when we're looking at that kind of care.
Okay, and in your supervisory role, what do you believe is the number one thing you should teach your team about treating the whole person?
Sometimes I think of just the word context, that context is what matters, right? Anyone, you know, we can do a referral, someone can write a prescription, but that's only as meaningful as how that connects to the person receiving that information. So context matters, functioning matters, what people want for themselves, and then also what is happening medically. So we're always thinking of the whole person and other care that happens. So I am very interested in your history of behavioral health, but I'm also interested in your medical appointment that you had at the emergency department yesterday, that it all is connected.
Mm. We're going to turn to Dr. Aaron, and this question is for all three guests, but we'll just start with Dr. Aaron. In your daily practice, what's the most common way you see persons' mental state speaking through their physical body and vice versa?
Yeah, I think I was thinking about this because it's everything. I mean, every way they present, every symptom that they have is going to be intertwined. But I think one of the things I look for that might be a little bit different is what's interfering or impeding their ability to access the treatment plan. So, you know, if they're coming in and they have a medical diagnosis and then this is the treatment plan we give them, how easy is it for them to be able to do those things? And oftentimes it's not easy. And then that tells me that there's something else, some grief, some stress, some trauma kind of getting in the way.
Okay, Brandy, would you like to chime in?
Sure. When I read this question, I primarily go to children, and I think a lot about the kids that our school-based clinicians serve, and that their primary way of getting their needs met when their emotional needs can't be met elsewhere is through physical symptoms. And so you'll see chronic visits to the nurse for upset stomach. And it's not that their stomach's upset, but it's upset, and I know I can get connection if I let someone know about it, and I maybe make it a little bit bigger than it is. And so really helping kids and adolescents figure out how to get their needs met while acknowledging their physical symptoms, but knowing that they don't have to make it bigger than it is to be able to get someone's attention.
Wow, that's got to be tough for a young person trying to get their needs met. Thank you for bringing that up. Is there any other issue that we might see in children or adolescents that may not be present with an adult?
I think kids are, you know, in some ways they are they're more vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so they're not as sophisticated always at, showing up in ways that that adults do, because we see this issue with adults in the emergency room as well. It doesn't stop if you can't get your needs met. You'll continue to get them met in the way that you can get them met. But I think for kids, you know, you have accidental falls, or you have lots of bumps and bruises, or you have, you know, ways of self-injury sometimes that are about getting their needs met through their physical symptoms and getting care. If I can't ask for a hug, but you'll put a Band-Aid on my scratch, then I'm still getting a need met. And so trying to help kids and figure out how to get their needs met and ask for it, you know, is one of the primary ways we can create change and long-term health.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, how about in your daily practice, what's the most common way you see a person's mental state speaking through their physical body and vice versa?
I think just to add to what Brandy and Aaron already said, I think of insomnia. Mm-hmm. I think of sleep all the time, and really appreciating once it came to me in my growth and development in my life, how impactful it really ends up being. And so sleep as a issue for a lot of people, and where that really shows up.
Okay. We often talk about carrying the weight of the world on our shoulders. In your work, what are the most common physical hiding places for stress that people don't realize could be mental health signals? I think you shared some, sleep and stomach pains, but what else?
Sleep was going to be the very first thing that I thought of, is, you know, sleep and certainly stomach. I think there are certain symptoms that are more vulnerable to stress and trauma and grief and emotion and certain places that we hold that. The biggest thing that I think is really categorizes this is pain, whether it's stomach pain, head pain, muscle pain. You know, we have whole fields of pain psychology that is all about the physical manifestation of pain and the emotion, how that impacts that.
Mm. And I just was thinking about this really embarrassing thing that happened to me during COVID, speaking of our bodies, as I was very stressed. And when we moved to Zoom, I realized that my shoulders were at my ears for the first time until I saw myself on the camera. Like, seeing that was, I was like, oh gosh, I, you know, this is how I look. But realizing that even our muscular system, when we're holding tension like that for long periods of time, makes us prone to injury. Causes significant pain, causes sleep disruption, causes quality of life issues, mobility issues. And so really noticing that the way we carry our stress and our pain is sometimes visible, not even to ourselves, but to other people. And no one would have said, hey, Brandy, by the way, you look like a turtle. Can you put your shoulders down? But it was really a really important lesson, that the unfortunate gift of COVID that I got just from my own body.
Okay, Sarah, would you like to chime in?
Yeah, I think the only thing to add is sometimes also the ability to bounce back when we have these physical things happening over time, and when it ends up impacting that. And then I think the only other thing to add would just be, I think of our gastrointestinal digestive mm-hmm. kind of system, and where that ends up showing symptoms as well.
Okay, Dr. Aaron, as a psychologist, you see the wiring between the brain and the body. We hear about the nervous system having two modes, fight or flight, and then rest and digest. Can you explain the difference between the two and what happens in your body with each?
Yeah, this is such a great topic, and I actually talk about this a lot when I think about psychoeducation of anxiety and stress and, you know, fight or flight, and also adding in fawn and freeze are our responses to some kind of unexpected or external stimuli. Often we think about that as a fear or a trauma. So something happens that is unexpected, and it doesn't always have to be unexpected. You know, we think about people in high stress situations. Fight, flight, fawn, or freeze would be the biological state that our body goes into in response to that. And really, at any given time, our body very much wants to get back to baseline. And the baseline is going to be different for each person, and very much informed by our history and our culture and, you know, our environment and our patterns of thinking and feeling and, you know, all the things that make up who we are. But our body wants to get back to a baseline where the rest and digest would happen. So I think about that as more of like a process and the state, the things that our body would be doing at baseline versus the things that our body does when it's activated by something else going on.
Well, we've got to go into our first break. We've gotten to know our guests and are heading into our break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation on the mind-body connection and discuss the direct impact of physical health on mental health and vice versa. Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Before the break, we heard from our guests, Sarah Schweitzer and Brandy Stratman, licensed clinical social workers, and Dr. Aaron Newlands, a licensed clinical psychologist. We're discussing the connection between both mental and physical health. All right, so we are going to continue our discussion on the mind-body connection. Brandy, we often hear the phrase, the body keeps the score. It's also the title of a very popular book. For someone who thinks their past trauma is safely locked away in their memories, how does the physical body actually remember what the mind is trying to forget?
I'm glad you brought this up. I think the body doesn't have the luxury of forgetting about safety. And so even if something is too overwhelming for our mind to hold on to an experience, our body will often remember the thing to protect us. And it can remember a story early on in my training about 9/11, where for months after, when people would hear a plane going over in New York, people would duck. That wasn't a conscious thought. That was a body responding to trauma and trying to prepare itself for safety. And so what we often see in people is that they want to forget something, but when they walk into a room and they see someone who looks like someone who harmed them or smells like someone that harmed them, their body sends off all sorts of warning signals that they can't control. And so that is one of the ways that we help people really get bought into this idea of healing, is that they want to be more in control again. They want to help their body know they're safe so that when they walk into a room, they can see what's really there and assess for safety accurately versus seeing what the potential threat is based on a history that could be 20 years before.
This next question is for all three guests. When we experience stress or trauma, our bodies go into fight or flight mode. What does that mean? And what happens to our physical health when that alarm system gets stuck in the on position long after the actual threat is gone? How about Dr. Aaron? Yeah.
I think you sort of said it in the question, is that the alarm system gets flipped to on and we can't flip that off. And like Brandy was talking about, walking into a room and seeing these cues that maybe you aren't actually consciously aware of that are triggering or popping up. And, I think, again, I talk about how impacted this alarm system is by our history and our environment and our learning and our culture and all of our patterns. And what happens is it gets hypervigilant and then everything becomes an alarm. And it's hard to distinguish what is an alarm and what isn't an alarm and the pain that that causes. And really, that's the point of therapy, is untangling that.
Mm. You used a word, hypervigilance. Mm. Would you explain what that means?
Yeah. Clinically, when we think about the term hypervigilance, we think about excessive awareness to the environment, usually with a connotation of discomfort or anxiety or fear. So it's somebody that's sort of constantly scanning. And this is something that can actually be encouraged and productive and helpful in certain contexts, like somebody in the military or somebody in a high stress environment, somebody in healthcare perhaps, is really paying attention to everything that's going on. But that state over that amount of activation over too much time can really throw things out of whack.
Okay. Sarah, how about chiming in on what it means for the on button to be stuck?
Part of what I was thinking of when Aaron was sharing was thinking about the cumulative impact of that over time and how that impacts our health. And I imagine someone maybe living in a domestic violence situation, mm-hmm. and how when you have to be on alert to try and stay safe, how hard it can be to distinguish when you don't have to be on alert or what does feel safe. And so just how challenging that is over time and how that impacts our health over time.
Okay. Before we get your answer, Brandy, we're going to take a call. We have Lawrence on the line with a question about seniors. Lawrence, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I'm here. Thank you so much for taking my call. You know, you're talking a lot about the mind-body equilibrium, which is wonderful. I'm 77 years young.
So all right.
Longer, you know, besides, So besides, you know, like, you know, rest and exercise and socializing and eating healthy, are there any other considerations that someone in my age bracket should think about regarding a healthy equilibrium?
We'll turn to our guests. That is a wonderful question, Lawrence. Sarah is going to check in with you here.
First, I just want to highlight, Lawrence, like, good for you. You are doing all the right things. That is really, really awesome. I do think specifically for our elders, I think about what are you doing to keep your mind aware and present and sharp. And so I do think social connections and risk of loneliness can be a huge piece. And then I also think what are we doing to keep our memory intact and our brain challenged? How are we making sure we're taking care of other things like our hearing? Fall prevention, right? We want people to stay as independent and living the life they want to lead as long as possible. So what are some of the other things that we need from our community and from our healthcare to ensure that will happen?
I also think, I love that, and all of those really yummy health things that we can do. And I also think thinking about your values, what brings you joy, what makes you feel fulfilled and like your best self, what things you really bring light to your life. And so doing those things that, or making time in your life to do things that bring you joy still.
All right. And Brandy, would you like to add anything?
Sure. The only thing that I would just share is that I think I love all those answers, by the way, ladies. That was a brilliant response. And kudos to you, sir. You are doing quite well. But also one of the things that I noticed from seniors is just a loss of a sense of purpose and how to keep redefining that as we age and how we remain connected to purpose through service, whether that be volunteering or caring for someone else who's less fortunate or less mobile than yourself, tends to be another area to keep yourself young.
Right. Thank you so much for your call, Lawrence.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Brandy, we'll turn back to you with the question about what one can do if the on position for that alarm system that our body has, that fight or flight or freeze or fawn, what can we do when that button is turned on?
I think, mindfulness is one of the best tools that we can use to really help ourselves in that moment when our on button has been stuck on for a long time, and recognizing that some people have that on button that's been switched on since they were infants and they didn't get needs met early on, and they never anticipated that someone would meet a need, so they just shut that down and internalizing that stress. Again, therapy, movement, finding different modalities that help your nervous system heal so that you can get calm and learn what it feels like to be in a calm body. Sometimes a calm body doesn't feel safe to people. And creating space for calmness to also equal safety is something that takes work and practice.
Yeah, when people hear the word mindfulness, sometimes they think of meditation. And are there any other aspects of mindfulness that folks might want to hear about or know?
Mindfulness is paying attention. It's whatever you're paying attention to. And I think sometimes we make it more complicated than it needs to be. As soon as you've gotten distracted and realize that you're distracted, you're being mindful to the fact that you were distracted.
All right.
The only little thing I would add to that are just small ways that we can be present in the moment. So I think of awe. You see a beautiful sunset. We might go to take a picture of it, but instead, can we hang out in a few moments and just appreciate the beauty of it? Or similarly with savoring. So rather than maybe a big handful of M&Ms, taking one or two and savoring the flavor of the chocolate just for a little bit longer.
Sarah, I feel like you spoke to my soul. So we talked about the flight or fight. I would like for us to examine rest and digest as part of the body's mm-hmm. stress response. And we know that it's what brings us back to that equilibrium that you all were talking about. I'm really curious, and maybe someone who is listening is curious, about the digestive piece of mental health. Sometimes people talk about having a gut feeling, and Brandy talked about, you know, maybe adolescents or children having a stomach ache. And feeling like their stomachs are in knots. Physiologically speaking, just how deeply connected is our digestive system with our emotional state?
We could go on for hours and hours, and I actually love the research that's coming out about this in the books and everything. Really, we think about our stomach as, they call it the second brain, right? And I often with kids use the metaphor that our brain and our stomach are best friends and they have each other on speed dial, although I don't know that they really understand what speed dial means anymore. maybe they're snap friends, but they have a direct line to each other. So when your brain is feeling those emotions or having those experiences, it dumps directly into the stomach, and vice versa. When your stomach is activated, it can actually activate your brain. So yes, very deeply are they intertwined.
Okay. And how do we address the physical health impacts of childhood trauma that are showing up in your adult patients, Sarah?
When I think about maybe a typical primary care visit with one of our customer owners, I think sometimes we think about the relationship our providers, our nurses, our medical assistants have with the customer. And I think part of what we're looking for is when the time is right to make that connection and discuss maybe how that's impacting things like pain. I also think it's a helpful opportunity to decrease feelings like shame or guilt when we can make that connection about where some of these health impacts are coming from. But when I think about things like adverse childhood experiences, I always caution focusing on that without also being really empowering around the strengths and resiliencies factors that people have that have helped them to survive.
Mm. And how do social determinants of health, like housing or food insecurity, create physical stress that damages the body?
When I think about that, I think a little bit about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and really we need to address those social determinants of health simultaneously, maybe first, right? We want to support them in making health behavior changes, but really how can we do that if you're unhoused or being really impacted by poverty? So has huge impacts on health, and we really want to look at what are those concrete supports aside from quality health care that we're all providing, but what does that look like in the community? What does that look like in the schools?
All right, Brandy. When we think of the physical aspect of mind and body, we hear a lot about a somatic experience. Can you share what a somatic experience is?
Absolutely. So a somatic experience, when we think about things that happen to us, it is energy that's trapped in our body and is stored in our nervous system and causes a physical response to that. And so when we think about people who often walk around with their completely hunched over, and they look like they're in pain, right? We would say somatically they're having an experience of shame or of pain in some way, and it's expressing itself in their body in this way that we can see. And somatic therapy is a way that we use to notice what's happening in the body along with the story. We've talked a lot about the connection so that we can work on that. So it's noticing it. It's like, oh, I noticed when you talked about that really scary experience, I saw you look down and you weren't looking at me anymore. What happened there? And so it's a subtle noticing, as Aaron was talking about with mindfulness. It's sort of bringing it all together. You're noticing what's happening to your body with acute care and therapy so that you can move through it, and you'll see people's body actually shift throughout mm-hmm. the course of therapy and addressing these things.
I think as I'm listening to both of you talk, I think I'm realizing one of the places where I see this so much in the hospital is actually in the parents of the kids. So you talked about, you know, when is the right time to connect back and like when and how do we do this? And I think in some ways, a lot of the trauma that happens, I have so many parents that are experiencing acute trauma from their children being in the hospital, but then just the practice of becoming a parent and then having your child have needs and having to meet your child's needs often brings up childhood trauma for parents, right? This is a very common thing that having kids brings up trauma for parents. And then in the hospital, they're being expected to process that, regulate that, and attend to their children's needs at the same time. And one of the most common things we do, especially in the NICU for that, is skin to skin. It's holding. And so it's that co-regulation, that physiological, just pause for a moment and feel your baby and feel that connection, that mindfulness. And that in and of itself is therapeutic, is the therapy, it's the intervention. And so I just think a lot of this kind of ties back to the physical, the things that we do in the moment is this mindful, evidence-based sort of intervention to help people process their trauma live as they're in a medical situation.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Aaron, you use the term NICU. So that is NICU? What does that
stand for? Yes, sorry. The NICU is the neonatal ICU. Okay. And then the PICU is the pediatric ICU. So these are the children that are very, very sick and in the ICU units, and the NICU would be the new babies.
All right. Just really quickly, what are some somatic or physical symptoms of common mental health disorders like depression, anxiety, or even panic?
I think we've talked a lot about this in various ways, but I think when we think about depression and anxiety specifically, it impacts all of our systems. So cardiovascular, respiratory, your muscular system, our neurological systems, our digestive system. This is why, as Aaron started with it, it didn't make any sense ever to separate them to begin with, because every system of our body is impacted by our behavioral health and depression and anxiety, no matter how severe, or to the most severe cases, right? We have people with severe depression with catatonia, and their body literally shuts down to the point of not functioning, even meeting basic needs. So it really is relevant in all of our systems.
Thank you for that. We're going to take our final break. If you have a question or comment for our guests, we're going to explore integrated healthcare and what it is and how it is connected with caring for both the mind and body. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Monique Andrews. Joining us today are clinical psychologists Dr. Aaron Newens and Brandy Stratman and Sarah Schweitzer, who are both licensed clinical social workers. Before the break, our guests explored the mind and body connection and what it physically and mentally can look like. Now we'll dive into healthcare and how integrated healthcare works and how it helps to care for both mental and physical health together. Coming back, Sarah, when we are talking about the connection between mental and physical health, we often hear the phrase integrated care. And I think you all were saying that throughout the show today. Would you mind sharing exactly what integrated care means?
Absolutely. So integrated care means that the care is happening where it began, which is why we try and bring everything we can to primary care. So part of what that does is it reduces stigma. So when you meet with a behavioral health consultant, you don't go to a different room. We come right into the exam room where the care was happening. We build off the relationship you already have with your provider. We also are in the same electronic health record. So it's continuity, it's comprehensive, and it's routine. So this means behavioral health is not an other thing. It is standard, and it's expected that we talk about this as a regular part of good care.
Thank you. And now we're going to turn to a caller. We have Judy, who is going to talk to us a little bit about elder resources. Judy, are you there?
Oh, yes. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, well, I'm a senior, and I used to give people, seniors, rides to the senior center because they used to have a lovely lunch there, and pretty much all the seniors in town would show up for it. But then they closed it. Been closed for a couple of years anyway, and I think it's just terrible that it is closed, because sometimes that's the only social event a senior would have during the day.
So I asked them, and they didn't know, and they said it was funding and all that, but who would be the person that I could call who would actually be interested in that? Do you know, or should I just keep calling around?
You know, there is the Alaska Commission on Aging, and I do not have that phone number readily available, but if you Google Alaska Commission on Aging, that would be a wonderful resource to start with. Do any of our guests have any suggestions?
I think another option would just be you can always call 211 for other community resource information. And even though our elders program at South Central Foundation serves Alaska Native American Indian beneficiaries, I bet they're some of the experts on what else is happening in the community. There's also the Aging and Disability Resource Center as well. So lots of places, and we sure don't want to send you on a wild goose chase, but there are resources, and it is for sure a loss when those things happen and impact kind of the health and well-being of our seniors.
Okay. And thank you, Judy, for your call. We really appreciate the question.
Well, I thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye, Judy. All right. We have another caller, Kristen, who is asking about family members and care involving family members. Kristen, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Please share your question.
Well, many times within a family, one child will have perhaps mental and emotional issues that will affect their physical well-being, and at the same time, or a family member, an adult family member, like an older brother or sister who's an adult, or like a father, grandparent, or something like that, will be having mental health and emotional problems. And I'm just wondering if you engage in any integrated thing with the whole family, because many children, when they see or growing up with a family member who are having problems, can feel that they themselves are being neglected, that somehow their needs are not being totally met. And on one hand, they might understand, yes, there's something wrong with a baby sister or, you know, baby brother or something, or there's something wrong with dad or mom. But, you know, they're going, but I need help too. You know, I need attention too. I have problems, which may not be horribly acute at that time, but could grow with time.
Yeah.
So is there, like, programs for the whole family where the children and other family members can not feel like somehow their needs are being neglected?
All right. Thank you so much for your question. Erin, Brandy, Sarah?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, and absolutely, I think that's on my mind all day, every day, and, you know, in from my perspective in the hospital, almost everything that I do is family based and really family oriented, with the unit as a whole and the functioning of the unit. And family therapy is a very specific kind of separate thing where we do that work as the work. It's the family unit as the patient or client. And I think there's family therapy available in Anchorage, but I think just as a whole, the field of psychology is really moving towards understanding the patient in the context, like Sarah was saying earlier, of their family, and for each child, how that's all impacting and how it intertwines. And so, you know, my first suggestion always is each child, when there's somebody in the family unit that's struggling, should be seen by their pediatrician and by the, you know, if there's integrated care there, that's part of their care too. And so, there are always, that's always the focus. I think in the hospital, we have child life that actually, like, specifically focuses on siblings often, among other things.
The only thing I would add as well in our primary care setting is we really encourage the whole family to empanel to the same provider. So the same provider is seeing the children, is seeing the parents, is seeing auntie, is seeing grandpa. So then you have a whole team of people who can see that whole context happening at the same time. I think it's really challenging if everyone has different providers in different settings. So that's one of the ways we try and address that early on.
All right. And Dr. Aaron, so answering that question was Dr. Aaron and Sarah Switzer. Thank you so much for your question. All right. For listeners, we'll turn back to Dr. Aaron. For listeners who have only ever experienced traditional healthcare, paint a picture for us. What does it actually look like when a primary care physician and a psychologist work together in real time?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it as live responding to a need. I think Sarah talked about this earlier, that it happens in the room, in the context, in the moment. So, in my work, it would be, you know, the hospitalist or the intensivist would see a need and then immediately be able to bring me and the support team in to help with the need. So it's live time responding in the moment.
Right. We're going to take an email. Jenny Luden would like for our guests to discuss how electronic medical records can either help or hinder integrated health care between medical and mental health.
Gosh, what a great question. yeah. I hate charting, but I try to see it as a tool of integrity. So making sure that I am keeping mindful of the work that I'm doing and that the other people on the team can follow that and see that. So it's not just the live conversations that I'm having at the nurse's station, but it's also they can go and see my treatment plan and, you know, print it out and post it in the room. And so it, to me, when EMRs are being done well, it really is an integrity tracking of the good care that we're providing.
I think the only thing I would add is just it really helps for more seamless communication between all those different care providers. So it should equal better care, that we can see kind of the whole picture of your health in one place. I also think, too, when I think about health portals and you being able to access your own information from the EHR, I think it is mostly helpful. It should be empowering. It is your life. It is your health. It's your body. So I hope it helps with self-efficacy and people's control and confidence in having decisions over their body. I think my only caveat is sometimes I worry about people looking at their labs at 11 o'clock at night in bed without having someone to talk to in that moment. But I do think our portals are getting more and more advanced, that it connects you to care. And of course, everyone is also using Dr. Google. So I think having some facts about your health to compare to what you're seeing on social media or Googling can be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I would add is just that often as professionals, due to the necessity to document to the level of care, we are often documenting to the problem. So we are often not talking about always the things that are going very well in documentation, especially on the behavioral health side for reimbursement. And so I think as a patient, it's always good to have those conversations with your provider. If you do read something that makes you uncomfortable or that you question or you're not sure about, that you're asking, what does that mean or why does it say that? Because the way that we reimburse care in this country is that we have to have a problem and we have to document to the problem. And so it's a dance. That is the darker side of the EMR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. All right. We have another caller, Becky, who is going to talk about some resources that are near Palmer. Becky, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm in Talkeetna. I heard, I believe it was Julie, talking about the loss of the senior lunch program here in Talkeetna at the Upper Sioux Fitna Senior and Community Center. The Upper Sioux Fitna Food Pantry has a program where they provide, in collaboration, a senior lunch twice a month, as well as like a voucher at a local restaurant, a couple of local restaurants now. So that could be a resource as well. One of the food pantries or the Alaska Food Bank, or call Luann at the Upper Sioux Fitna Food Pantry and discuss how she implemented that program.
Thank you, Becky. What wonderful resources. As we are talking, thank you so much for your call and information, Becky. As we are continuing to talk with our three guests, Dr. Aaron Newlands, Brandy Stratman, and Sarah Schweitzer. I do have a question. When someone gets a difficult diagnosis, like diabetes or a heart condition, there definitely can be psychological tolls, right? How does an integrated care team prevent that patient from falling into maybe depression that might sabotage their physical recovery?
Early detection and intervention.
That was Dr. Aaron.
I think just to add to that, I think of anticipatory guidance. So what does this mean now? What does this mean in the future? And I think also being clear, how does this not just impact me, but my family? And so what are the things we want to pay attention to? And ideally trying to stay out of kind of crisis mode about it, but being really real and acknowledging what this means and how that might impact our sense of self.
Thank you, Sarah. So it sounds like the data shows that treating the mind and body together leads to better outcomes and lower healthcare costs. Why is integrated care still an exception rather than the rule in so many places?
I think one reason is, I would say most probably master's level clinicians have not been trained in this model. So I think staffing is a challenge for behavioral health very much in our state, but also across the country. I also think about challenges with billing. And I also think, we have the privilege to really do work that's based on innovation and improvement and quality about relationship-based care. And I think it can be hard the way that our system is set up nationally, that it's really based more on quantity. And that is challenging.
Yeah. Brandy, how can patients effectively track their physical symptoms alongside their mood to show their doctor the potential connection?
I think, for people who are comfortable having a little notepad and writing those things down, that's wonderful. As I've kind of moved through my career, I've noticed that I think older and younger generations are now moving more towards app-based tracking. And so there's a couple apps that I encourage children, adolescents, and adults to use. One is called Bearable, and that's an app you can track your sleep, your health, your mood, and then look at when those things coincide. For women, it also tracks your menstruation, so you can see if your cycle is impacting your mood and other health, other health things that might be happening in your body, as well as a free one is human.health, and that is also an app that's available to track your behavioral health and your medical symptoms as well.
Thank you. Okay, not everyone has access to integrated care right now. So for the listener heading to their regular doctor appointment tomorrow, what is one question they can ask their provider to ensure their mental health is being considered as part of their overall medical care?
I would say I want people to be empowered to ask questions, and just like we should be able to ask questions about our own health, hopefully providers, whatever the type of provider it is being curious about context. I think routine screening, so hopefully people are getting care at places that are routinely screening for things like depression, substance use, and then again, having relationships with people who are listening. Listening to the story, listening to the concerns, and being curious clinicians and not assigning meaning too quickly.
Mm-hmm. I also think sometimes, a little trick that I give people is if they're feeling like it's too much to say, like, I'm struggling mentally, or I'm wondering if I'm struggling mentally, or how is this going to impact me mentally? A question that they can ask is something like the patient themselves can say, how has this thing that I'm dealing with impacted others mentally in the past? Like, other patients that you've had with this, how is this impacting their mental health? And then that starts that conversation in a little more innocent way.
All right. Well, we are ending our show. I want to sincerely thank all of our guests, Brandy Stratman, Sarah Schweitzer, and Dr. Aaron Newens for sharing their expertise and the important work they're doing in integrated healthcare here in Alaska. If you or someone you love is struggling right now, please know you aren't alone. You can call 988 anytime or reach out to the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-4357. Thanks to our audio engineer, Crystal Hyde, and our producers. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.